You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The intervention in Libya led to a heated debate over whether it needed to be authorized by Congress and whether it will be successful in its goals. Defending the decision, President Obama said, "Given the costs and risks of intervention, we must always measure our interests against the need for action. But that cannot be an argument for never acting on behalf of what's right. The belief that we have a moral obligation to intervene, even when it's risky or dangerous, is one of the things Rory Stewart and Gerald Noss discuss in their book, Can Intervention Work? It's published by Norton as part of the Amnesty International Global Ethics Series. Mr. Stewart has been a guest on the show a number of times, but that was before he became a member of the British Parliament. I'm very pleased he was able to join us today before he returns to London to deal with issues resulting from the recent rioting and other matters. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you very much.
There have been numerous interventions over the past century. Have you chosen to focus on the military and political interventions in Afghanistan and the Balkans because you had personal experiences in both of those places?
Yeah, that was the starting point. I served as a British diplomat in Bosnia and Kosovo and then in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I also believe that the last 20 years has been, in a sense, two decades of intervention, that the end of the Cold War has really led to a whole new period in human history where the national security of the United States and NATO and Europe has become increasingly bound up with intervening in other people's countries.
What's the background of the typical foreign official in Afghanistan?
I think that this is something that's very important and very worrying. In effect, foreign officials in Afghanistan are very isolated from the local community. They tend to live in guarded embassy compounds. Increasingly rare for people to speak local languages fluently, to ever spend a night in a village house. And that this means that if you compare it to what it would mean to be a civil servant operating in the United States, where you come from the same culture, obviously you speak English, you travel on the bus every day, that is a totally different relationship. But when we go to Afghanistan, we go to Iraq, we go to Bosnia or Kosovo, we have this very, very strange, detached, almost surreal distance from reality.
To some degree, it's because our lives are in danger. How much training do these people get in the language, history, and culture of the country they're going to?
Increasingly little. One of the sad things is that whereas the State Department or the British Foreign Service used to put huge emphasis in its promotions and its movements on area and country expertise, increasingly, for example, in Britain, you can be promoted right the way up to the top of the system without speaking a local language fluently, because people somehow imagine we're in some strange globalized world where languages don't matter, culture doesn't matter, and that you can drop in a second from Rio to Kabul.
But this goes against the whole British sense of history. Lawrence of Arabia was a British hero because he integrated himself into the culture that he was working with. Have the British forgotten their own history?
I think that that's a very good point. I think the British are following a fashion which is happening right the way around the world, where foreign services are being run down, where cultural expertise is being run down, and that applies as much to Britain as it does to other countries.
Well, it sounds to me like they're all following the American model.
Well, one of the problems is that we talk a lot about a globalized world, we talk a lot about a universe without frontiers or boundaries. We imagine that the issues that really confront us are climate change or trade issues, or we imagine the internet somehow erodes all cultural differences. But the reality is that the most problematic countries in the world are often very isolated places like Afghanistan, which are not really part of some great generic global cosmopolitan conversation. In Afghanistan, it's not simply that very few people speak English. When I was at the police training camp in Helmand in November, only 8 out of 100 recruits into the police could write their name or recognize the number up to 10.
And yet we're trying to train them through English or through translators to do really complicated jobs.
Yes, and the training course turns out to be 5 weeks long. And if you take in a guy who cannot read or write, has had no form of education, put them through a 5-week course, the person who emerges at the end is not what you or I would call a policeman.
Now, you also contrast the way foreign policymakers in the 19th century did their jobs. And you draw a comparison between Viceroy John Lawrence, who worked in India, with Richard Holbrooke. Do you think it's necessary to spend a career in a country in order to enact meaningful reforms there?
I believe that the biggest danger that we face today is that this isolation of our policymakers, the very abstract jargon that we use, whether it's talking about democracy or governance or the rule of law, and the incredible optimism of our culture, our sense that every problem has a solution, is currently floating free. There aren't enough people in the system to stop it, to say on the basis of 20, 25 years working in a country, no, I'm sorry, you're not going to be able to do this. It doesn't work like that. These are real obstacles and challenges that you need to overcome.
You said that the typical experience of a foreign official who serves in Afghanistan is to be totally isolated. So what ultimately does that mean? How much does he have to know about what the average citizen's life is like to deal with Hamid Karzai?
Well, the claims of the international community in Afghanistan are astonishing. I remember when I walked across the country the winter of 2001-2002, and I stayed in, I suppose, 35 different village houses on that walk. And night after night, I'd sat there and I'd listen to different people, mullahs or village chiefs, talk about religion or government. I arrived in Kabul and I found myself in a room where UN officials and US officials were standing up and saying, there is a consensus in Afghan society. Every Afghan is committed to a gender-sensitive, multi-ethnic, centralized state based on democracy, human rights, the rule of law. And it is fantasy. I mean, it's a surreal...
This is total Western optimism?
Well, it's an astonishing refusal to take on the reality of Afghanistan, which is a place which has enormous joy and generosity and kindness, but is a very, very diverse, intractable, often conservative society. And throwing around those kinds of buzzwords is not helpful. What's helpful is understanding what is happening in one specific village, not making great generalizations about state building.
But haven't we learned a lot since? We know the difference between an Azeri and a Pashtun.
Yes, we do indeed. And one of the extraordinary things about the modern world is that politicians right the way across from Spain to Brazil can talk about Pashto tribal structures now, or they can talk about the responsibility to protect. But actually the knowledge that we have is very, very, very slender. It's pathetic if you compare it to the kind of knowledge that you would expect if you were trying to run a project in for example, on urban poverty in Chicago. It would be the equivalent of my being able to say, oh yes, in the United States there are people of German descent and people speak English and some people speak Spanish and I can name the states the United States. It doesn't mean you have any idea whatsoever how to achieve change.
Do you think that this isolation has resulted in all the failed projects that we have seen? A couple of months ago, I talked to some filmmakers who followed U.S. Marines into small town, and one of the projects that they put together was a park in the center of town with park benches and everything, and they were very disappointed that nobody went there.
Right. I think you need so much grounding in reality to get anything done. I've been running a small nonprofit in Kabul, and during the 5 years that we've been working, getting very simple things done, getting the water supply in, getting the electricity in, repairing 65 buildings, setting up a small elementary school, these things are very, very tough. The Afghan government is corrupt. Communities can be suspicious. It's very difficult managing stuff. Everything takes twice as long as you expect. And that's when we're operating in a very, very fixed, known community in the center of the old city of Kabul. If you come in as a military unit on a 12-month tour, plop down in the middle of a town and try to just set up a project from scratch, you start enormously cheerfully and maybe even finish your tour thinking we've done these great things. But if you were to return again 2 years later, generally there's almost nothing left. These things are so difficult to sustain.
Some of the projects have worked, haven't they?
Yes, in the very early days, with very few troops, ironically, and little money, 2002, 2003, 2004, a great deal was achieved in Afghanistan. 3 million women returned to school, 85% of people got access to health clinics. It's an explosion of mobile telephone use. But those things were achieved, actually, ironically, at a time when everybody said we were distracted by Iraq, when everybody said we weren't investing enough, we didn't have enough troops. Ironically, from 2005 onwards, as we began to focus more on Afghanistan, we began to bring in more troops and more money, the situation got worse, not better.
Why have you called your NGO Turquoise Mountain Foundation? Doesn't sound very Afghani to me.
Turquoise Mountain is a translation of the Afghan word Firuz Kuh, which is the name of an ancient Afghan capital destroyed by Genghis Khan in 1222. And it was one of the great symbols of Afghan civilization, the center of an empire that stretched from Baghdad to Delhi. So we set up this NGO, this non-profit in Kabul, in order to restore traditional Afghan architecture, train people in traditional Afghan crafts, and we took the name to reflect that.
My guest is Rory Stewart, who's a member of the British Parliament and best-selling author of The Prince of the Marshes and The Places in Between. He has co-authored with Gerald Noss of Harvard a book called Can Intervention Work? It is published by Norton. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Rory Stewart, who has written with Gerald Noss, Can Intervention Work? It is published by Norton. And you mentioned the jargon of all of this. These projects. Why do you say the word intervention is used euphemistically to describe actions taken in countries like Bosnia, Rwanda, and Afghanistan?
Well, so when we go into Bosnia or Kosovo or Afghanistan, Iraq, we say we're intervening. This is intervention. And that's a very funny word because it means literally from the Latin to come between. So it sounds like quite a neutral thing. You're just arriving, you're separating a couple of parties, probably you've been invited into the country. The reality is we use this actually to cloak actions which are much more aggressive. You're going in there with tanks, with Humvees, with planes. You're not really intervening. You're interfering or you're invading.
Well, it also suggests that we have a superior position in this.
A lot of the assumption behind what we do is this country, wherever we happen to be going, is a victim, it's a troubled place, it's a failed state, it's a disaster, and we're coming in from the West to sort it out.
You tell an anecdote about an Afghan who complained about buzzwords foreign experts used to describe the problems in Afghanistan. What were some of the buzzwords he particularly disliked?
Well, what you need to understand is that, strangely, in Afghanistan, it's a world of management consultants. There's $125 billion a year being spent in Afghanistan, and it's used to employ people producing incredible feasibility studies, strategic plans, and everybody standing up. And Afghans have learned to imitate this and speak back, and they say, we must implement transparent, predictable, and accountable financial processes. We need to make sure that we focus on the political participation of the poor, the vulnerable, and the marginalized, particularly women. We need to focus on rule of law, on governance. And these words, which sound fine, probably, rule of law, governance, sounds like an unobjectionable thing, are actually surreally distanced from Afghan reality. They tell you almost nothing. They're sort of funny words taken half from management consultancy, half from some academic context, some professor, and they've been inserted into a very, very specific, poor, fragile, traumatized country in Central Asia, where they often have very little application.
So they don't really describe the reality. Did they describe a reality that that the West has constructed, but that really isn't true of the place we've gone into?
Well, let me give you an example. One of the things that everybody's been obsessed with in Afghanistan is the idea of creating a strong central government, transparent constitution, elections. And this isn't just us. This was true of the Soviet Union. It was true of the leftist governments in Afghanistan in the late 1970s. But the reality is a friend of mine like Commandant Walim Haji Mohsen Khan Kamenji, which sounds like a lot of names, but isn't. It's a lot of titles. And it means commander of the Jamiat militia, pilgrim to Mecca, hereditary chief of the Taimani Aimak, landlord of Kamenji. And this is a guy who has been the chief of his village under a Maoist government, under a Leninist government, under a Soviet occupation, then under a CIA-backed government, then he was a Taliban commander, and now he's back in again as a member of parliament for the district of Shahrak. So the gap between our idea of what's going on in that country, all our notions of a centralized democratic state, and the reality of power is the problem.
So we use specialized language like effective and accountable governance, which we say is to establish achievable goals for the intervention, but of course doesn't really mean anything.
Exactly.
Well, why did they use such abstract language to describe their goals?
Well, partly because we're looking for simple remedies. If we had to take on board the fact that Afghanistan consists of 20,000 villages, and that in every village there is a different form of power structure, and that power is highly decentralized, and you were a young European or American official or soldier arriving on the ground, you'd be in despair. Right? If you really felt that in order to do something constructive in the country, you actually needed to spend 15, 20 years on the ground, speak the language fluently, understand the tribal structures of the village, you'd just give up. So you fall back on saying, what we need to do is simply implement 10 things. We're going to set up everything from the rule of law to the legitimate monopoly on the use of violence. And here's a wonderful lesson that we learned from Bosnia, or here's something we can take from Somalia. We'll do a replace all. We'll replace the word Botswana with Afghanistan, and we'll find out what we're going to do.
One of the examples of jargon you analyze is ungoverned space. Why do foreign officials, what do they mean by ungoverned space?
There's this sort of idea in Afghanistan, and this goes with this idea of a failed state, that somehow Afghanistan is a white space, that it's an anarchic chaos.
Isn't it?
No. The reality is that I was able to walk across Afghanistan alone with my dog in the winter of 2001-2002 from the west of Afghanistan to the east safely. And I was able to do it because every village looked after me. Every village had a functioning structure. They looked after their insecurity. They knew who was in charge. They passed you on to the next village. And that was at a time when there was no government. The Taliban government had fallen. The Karzai government hadn't emerged. Now, this is something that we can't recognize. Americans and Europeans looking at that assume that that is a chaotic, anarchic state of nature. But actually, human societies, and Afghan society in particular, develop amazingly resilient ways of operating. It's not ungoverned space. It's densely governed, but in a way that we find difficult to recognize.
But when we talk about things like rule of law, are we talking about different laws in each space?
We are often talking about that. When we're talking about how legal systems operate in Afghanistan, the reality in a village is that if you commit a crime, you steal somebody's donkey, for example, you would be called up into a room where you would sit on the ground on a mud floor with a group of people with white beards, most of whom are related to you. People marry their first cousins in Afghan villages, and everybody in that room would know each other. They would know the victim, they would know the criminal. There would be no police, no prison, no judge, no law book. And that is how 85% of Afghans operate.
Not just Afghans, people all over the world. It's all changed to some degree as a result of the West trying to create nations, hasn't it?
Absolutely. This is very common around the world. The problem, though, from the Western point of view, is that all the investment that went into Afghanistan from 2001 to about 2008 went into the idea that what they were going to do is spend a lot of money on the creation of prisons, flying judges to Tennessee on training courses, distributing new legal codes. And the result of all this investment, hundreds of millions of dollars, is that by 2011, people still believe in many areas of Afghanistan that the Taliban justice is better than the formal justice of the government.
What we've been focusing on is creating a state in our own image?
Yes, it's not even really in our own image, because often the people who go to Afghanistan from the United States or Europe don't really understand the complexity of the United States or Europe very much either. It's a very abstract, idealistic idea of a kind of state that probably has never been seen or known to exist anywhere.
And we see progress in when we're imitated. For example, there was a film about a television show called Afghan Star, which is based on the British and American Idol type shows. And we saw that as a major advance. culturally? Well, I'm not sure American Idol is a major advance culturally in this country.
I think, and I think you, that's a very good example. I was 2 weeks ago. I was in the Panjshir Valley in the mountainous region of Afghanistan, talking to some Mujahideen people who'd fought against the Soviet Union, and they were picking out that show as representing everything they hated about modern Afghanistan. They said, you know, we sacrificed, we died. We're the remaining five of a unit of 40. We spent 8 years starving on the mountains, fighting the Soviet Union. And what do we do it for? We do it for this ridiculous television program. And so there is a culture war going on, of course, in Afghanistan itself. And we barely understand these things. We barely touch the surface of them.
But is this why Afghanistan has always been seen as unconquerable? There are other countries that seem to be more pliable.
Well, I don't know whether it's the unconquerable or pliable issue. There is a problem there. The problem is this. It's very easy to become so cynical and pessimistic that you feel nothing can ever be done anywhere. And my experience in Afghanistan and Iraq was very depressing. Ultimately, these places were humiliating. They were messes. So it is important to remember that in Bosnia, for example, the international community managed to get things done. In Bosnia, the international community succeeded in a very, very remarkable way against all the odds. And everybody, Cato Institute, for example, the think tank here in the United States, basically said there's no point doing anything in Bosnia. 92, 93, 95, they said it'll be another Vietnam, you're never going to be able to stop the civil war, Karadzic is going to take over the country, the refugees will never return, it's a total waste of time and effort. And they were totally wrong. So we can't become so gloomy and pessimistic that we give up on these things entirely. The lesson is a lesson of prudence.
My guest is Rory Stewart, who worked as a diplomat in Indonesia and the Balkans and traveled extensively through Afghanistan, where he established the Turquoise Mountain Foundation, a human development NGO. The essays in his new book, which he has co-authored with Gerald Noss, came out of a course that they taught at Harvard Kennedy School, and now it's published by Norton in this country. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What role has the military played in these interventions? Are the goals and language of military commanders any more precise than the foreign diplomats?
I think the military has been extremely serious and extremely professional and very dedicated, and they've made enormous sacrifices. The challenge is that the military has optimism in their DNA. They find it impossible to believe that there is any problem that doesn't have a solution. And although they will say there's no military solution, sometimes, they don't really believe it. They seem often to act as though every problem has a military solution.
And which is a surge, usually.
Yeah, and that always means if things are not going well, the problem is we don't have enough troops, we don't have enough resources, we haven't quite got the strategy right. So even today, and we've been in Afghanistan now nearly a decade, and we're spending $125 billion a year, and we got 135,000 troops on the ground, it's very easy to find a general who'll say, just give us another couple of years, just give us a few more troops, give us a few more time, and a bit more time, we'll crack this one.
Excuse me, you list quotes from each military commander as he takes over from the last, and it starts to sound like a broken record. They all say there was no clearly defined mission before and that they have new goals that will bring change within the year. So why don't they do something different?
Well, it's the fault really lies with the politicians in this case, but not in the way that one imagines. It's that the politicians need to confront the generals and say, we disagree. They need to find a way of saying to a general, and it's very difficult to do. I mean, imagine you're a civilian politician, I'm a politician. Now, some general comes in, medals all over his chest, 10 years on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq, and says, I can do this. Give me the resources, give me the helicopters, we can crack this one. It's very difficult to say, no, you're wrong. You're not going to be able to do this. There isn't a military solution. Your counterinsurgency strategy won't work.
We recently interviewed someone who'd written a book about the conflict over the years between the State Department and the Pentagon. And in almost every case, the Pentagon won.
The Pentagon wins because they have a clear, bold narrative, and it's very, very compelling. And the real problem that a politician faces is a problem of fear, a problem of guilt, a problem of optimism. In other words, problems of emotions. It's not about a rational conversation about exactly what is or isn't working in a particular village in Afghanistan. It's questions like, have the soldiers died in vain? That's what really drives this.
Well, we often hear when people are honoring the dead soldiers that they died to protect America. And obviously, people believe that. It's hard to imagine that they died in Afghanistan or Iraq to specifically protect America. Or have I missed something?
Well, it is the most difficult issue for anybody to deal with, whether it's a general or a politician or a civilian, because you're struggling really hard to talk about horrible things. Thousands of people have died. Tens of thousands of people have been injured and wounded. I believe, though, the reality is that the Taliban is extremely unlikely to be able to take over Afghanistan again, extremely unlikely to be able to take Kabul. Even if they did, they're extremely unlikely to be able to wish, actually, to invite back al-Qaeda. From their point of view, that was their number one mistake last time. If they hadn't invited al-Qaeda, they'd still be in power. And even if I'm wrong about those two things, so even if they took over the country, even if they invited back al-Qaeda, I think it's extremely unlikely that al-Qaeda would be able to significantly enhance its ability to harm the United States from Afghan soil.
But they can still cause a lot of trouble in Afghanistan, whether they wind up out of the government or in the government, as many people think they ultimately will be.
Absolutely. And Afghanistan is facing a real problem. And it's the same problem, to some extent, that we faced in Bosnia, which is that it feels as if there are only two choices, either a massive, eternal international presence or civil war. But the one thing that's missing in this conversation is any agency or independence for Afghans themselves. We talk about these countries as though it's all about us. Either we're there and everything's stable, or we're not there and everything's in civil war. The reality, of course, as we found in Bosnia, is that in the right situation, with the right conditions, what really led to stability were the actions of the Bosnians themselves. And in the end, the reason why I'm confident about Afghanistan in the 30-year period is I'm confident about Afghans.
Well, you say that intervention in the Balkans was successful because of a light footprint. So are we trading rather heavily in Afghanistan?
Yes, and when I say a light footprint, I don't mean that we didn't have a lot of troops. We had a lot of troops in Bosnia. But what I mean is that we were very prudent. We didn't try to do too much. We weren't too ambitious. In fact, in the first couple of years after 1995, we did almost nothing. A lot of the people who worked with us were very impatient. You know, why are you not locking up these war criminals? Why are you not pushing ahead with the refugee return? Why aren't you doing anything? But the answer was, by waiting, by not taking the lead, we allowed Bosnians themselves to take the lead. And then the international community were able, in a very intelligent way, to reinforce their action. So a Bosnian family returns to a village. The international community watches, supports them, sends in people to protect them. And in the end, we ended up in a situation where the crime rates in Bosnia today are lower than they are in Sweden.
That's impressive. Your co-author, General Noss, called the actions by international peacekeepers in Bosnia principled incrementalism. What did he mean by that?
Well, what he means is principled in the sense that you still have a moral, ethical agenda. You want to get refugees to return. You believe that the country should be multi-ethnic, not have ethnic cleansing in it. You believe that war criminals should be put on trial in The Hague. But you move gently. You don't imagine that what you need to do is come in with a great bang from the beginning, lock everybody in, flex your muscles, say we're in charge here. The model should not be some celebrity CEO international dictator who pushes the buttons. It should be a much, much more patient partnership.
Is there a possibility that the intervention in Afghanistan can be transformed into something like what you advocate in this book?
I think the only way in which you could hope to move in that direction ultimately is going to be to continue the path which the president has set, which is to start reducing the number of troops decisively and clearly. And I believe very strongly that by 2014 we should have no combat troops on the ground. We could keep a few thousand troops in a base. We could keep a few airplanes to stop the Taliban taking a major city. But we should not be conducting combat operations, because all those troops, all that money, leads us to micromanage Afghan affairs, interfere in the way things operate, and prevents any form of settlement between the various parties.
Well, many people cite the surge as a very positive thing. Do you think it wasn't?
No, I think it was a negative thing. I don't believe anything sustainable will be achieved through that deployment.
A caller asks, how do the villages that you stayed in treat women? Is Sharia law applied to women across the board, or do these villages have individual ways of treating women?
There's enormous differences in the way in which Afghan communities treat women. For example, in the Hazara communities, I remember staying in a village called Sangizat in central Afghanistan, women are much more part of public life. Even then, in the worst days of the Taliban, there were girls in the mosque, school. Women would sit with you at dinner. In other places, in Pashtun villages, I never saw a woman at all. The villagers would see me coming an hour away, and by the time I arrived in the community, it might as well have been an entire male community. And we've had the same challenges working in the inner city of Kabul, where we have managed to set up an elementary school, which is half men, half women. But in order to do that, we had the fathers of the girls sitting in the back row of the class for the first 2 weeks, checking what we were teaching their daughters.
Robert McNamara said in his 11 Lessons from the Vietnam War that we exaggerated the dangers to the United States. And you mentioned earlier that you don't think that Al-Qaeda would ever make a return, that Taliban is unlikely to take over the country. And of course, we talked about all of the dangers from Iraq before we invaded there. Why would we exaggerate the dangers of Afghanistan or Iraq?
Well, as somebody who's now a politician, I think it's easier for me to understand why politicians exaggerate dangers. The answer is it's very difficult to deploy troops on the ground and say, well, you know, this is a country that sort of matters. It's one of 40 countries around the world in which we have some interests and obligations. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't pose an existential security threat to the United States. If we're interested in terrorism, Pakistan is more important. If we're interested in regional stability, Egypt is more important. Nevertheless, we would like to keep some troop presence on the ground in order to contain and manage the situation. That kind of rhetoric doesn't work. The way in which you sell a war, the way in which you justify the loss of lives, the way in which you mobilize the money, the way in which you go out on the podium is to say, this is the most dangerous region in the world. The security of the United States and the world depend on what happens here. And all these other things come from this. You begin to talk about domino theories, as we did in Vietnam, and we have an equivalent in Afghanistan where we say, we're in Afghanistan because of Pakistan, or you say, the credibility of the United States is at stake. If we're defeated here, we're going to be humiliated and global Islamic extremists will come. But my sense is that these justifications, these fears, follow the decision to go in. They're justifications that follow the event.
We have described Afghanistan as a failed state. What you suggest is that in Western terms it will always be a failed state, that there's no way that we can change that and make it into some country that's governed from Kabul and where everybody kind of agrees, with even if they come up with some kind of a federalist approach.
I think you're absolutely right that there's no way that we, i.e. the international community, can turn it into the kind of country we want. But Afghans can. It has to be a local indigenous activity. The United States and its constitution was not created by foreigners. It was created by founding fathers, by people who deeply believed and committed to their country. Turkey has transformed itself since 1919. Afghanistan can also transform itself, but it has to be Afghan leaders, Afghan culture that's pushing this, not foreigners.
Where does the intervention in Libya fall in terms of the examples that you provide in this book? And do our actions in Libya suggest that we've learned anything from our recent interventionist campaigns?
I think the president's correct decision in Libya was to say we do have a humanitarian obligation, a limited humanitarian obligation towards the Libyan people. We're going to impose a no-fly zone and we'll protect thousands of people in Benghazi from being massacred. But we are not in this for a military operation for regime change, and we're not going to put troops on the ground. And I think that is a very positive step. It's a very difficult one. You can already see people being tempted to say, we've got to go after Gaddafi, we're going to get sucked in more deep. But The president's initial instincts are correct. It is possible to find a middle way, not to feel that you either do nothing or you do everything. It is possible, as I think he's trying in Libya to say, there are things the international community can do, from sanctions to no-fly zones, which may not transform the situation, but may be significantly helpful.
Before you go, just one other thing. A caller asked, do you believe that to deal with the recent riots in London and throughout other parts of Great Britain now, it's necessary to smash the gangs?
I think that, and this is maybe an easy thing for me to say because I'm not at the moment responsible for any of that policy in Britain, but I do feel, on the basis of my experience elsewhere in the world, that we do not understand what happened there, that we should not be rushing for a solution until we fully understand what happened.
I'm suggesting U.S. intervention.
Leave you to that, Leonard.
Thank you so much for being with us again, Rory Stewart, who is a British MP now, co-author with Gerald Noss of Can Intervention Work, which is published by Norton as part of the Amnesty International Global Ethics series of books. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back.